afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining us in the first post-Gary Lucy episode is my co-host for today. You guys know him as the host of Never Not Funny and the executive producer of this show, Mr. Jimmy Pardo. Jimmy.
Hello, Patty. I think executive producer is overstating what I do.
You give notes.
I give one note a year, uh-huh. And I lend my name so you guys get some publicity.
So we get listeners.
Yes.
We thank you for it.
My pleasure. Always happy to help.
Also, Matt is here, but Matt is not on mic today, but he is here for a couple of the next transitional episodes. Matt's here, and the reason he's not on mic is because we have two very, very special guests in the studio today. Jimmy and I are without a doubt gigantic fans of you guys. Of course, I'm speaking about the two surviving members of the Knack.
I love that.
Mr. Yeah. Prescott Niles and Mr. Burton Aver. Guys, how are you guys doing today?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing,
I got to check my pacemaker. Hold on.
By the way, for those of you not in the room, Matt doesn't have a mic, but he's a very accomplished mime.
No, actually, Matt represents the silent majority.
And let's so everyone knows who's who. Prescott, you talk first, and they'll know your voice.
Okay. They know my voice. It's, right. It's very sexy and hot.
No question about that.
And the other sexy gentleman.
I'm Burton. The way you tell us apart, he sounds like a bass guitarist and I sound like a lead guitarist.
Terrific.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Wait, does he sound lower and you sound higher pitch?
I was sneaking in some information.
Yeah, you play lead guitar and he plays bass. We'll get to that, Burton, to relax. This guy's a pro over on the other side.
At least I don't play oboe. That's a whole other discussion.
Oh, it's a bad instrument.
So now, you guys...
Use guys.
Hey, no, we're really excited. Every time I've seen you guys in concert, it's been with the gentleman across from me.
Really?
And,
yes.
And you saw them once before that. First time you saw them?
You guys at the Return of the Knack, 1986, at the Roxy.
Oh, cool.
And great that you guys came out, you did your set, you then did an encore. I forget what that song was. And then... Doug turned around to you guys and said, "Should we do one more?" And you go, "We don't know anymore." And you said it in such a way, and he goes, "All right." And then he went, "That's it for us." But I was right up against because I had never seen you guys. Obviously, it was 86, so, you know, it was 7 years after you guys were, mm-hmm. you know, the Knack.
Yeah.
And so I was living out here. I'm from Chicago, and I was living out here. I was going to school in Pasadena, and I drove into Hollywood, which is a big deal at the time. I mean, it's not a big deal now. It was a half-hour drive, but it seemed like I was going to the city, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. to see the Knack, to see one of my favorite bands of all time. Here they are reuniting. And people wanted to go with me. It's interesting. People wanted to, "Hey, I'll go with you." It's like, I don't want anybody just tagging along. This is a big deal for me. And I got there early, and I was up against that Roxy stage being pressed up against my thighs. And so I was able to literally hear you crystal clearly. "We don't know anymore."
Well, that's probably... First of all, it was a benefit for Michelle Meyer, who is the promoter, who I think was having cancer at the time. We only had a limited time to play. We're the type of band who could play for 3 hours on any... We could be a jukebox. Mm-hmm. We could play anybody's music, any style, right?
Yeah.
We'd often go off in jams. We could be Cream. We could be Hendrix. We could be Creedence.
We weren't Cream and we weren't Hendrix.
Well, we could fake it pretty good, especially with Bruce. But I think it was more of a polite statement because we did have a time limit.
Isn't that so? I didn't know that. All right.
Doug could have talked for the next 2 hours.
Well, that is true.
I'm glad you remembered that because my guess, because like you said, we could always break out covers. We were playing covers and like old, you know, Buddy Holly songs and Mersey era songs. We were just,
anything.
We would always regale ourselves with that in rehearsal. So I was thinking maybe I was just ready to get off.
It could be that. You're done.
You know? Yeah.
At any rate, it was phenomenal.
Thank you.
And then the first time I saw you guys was with Jimmy, and it was literally I was leafing through the LA Weekly. I think it was 96. But you guys will probably know the date better than me. And I leafing through, and it says, "The Knack at the Viper Room tonight." Oh, yeah. And I called Jimmy. I go, the Knack is at the Viper Room? He's like, "Oh, when? Tonight."
Let's go.
So we go down there. And literally, the Viper Room's about as big as the room we're in now. It's very tiny. It was all the original members. Bruce was with you that night. Mm-hmm. And the line is around the Viper Room. And here come you guys one at a time. You guys are just walk right by with your with your equipment, and right in the doors, you guys were. I remember Doug carrying a guitar case, and that was the first time I saw you guys. And I had known you from the records, but since I had never seen you play, I was astounded at the level of musicianship that I saw that night. Because I think a lot of times maybe people think of the Knack as, you know, a pop band or whatever, and that's fine. But man, can you guys, every single one of you, play your instruments? I was so impressed with the bass and Bruce's drumming and of course the guitar. It was phenomenal.
Vocal was average.
The vocal was average.
Musicianship was phenomenal.
And the stage patter left me wanting more. Yes. No. But it
how about the choreography?
Fantastic.
The choreography was nice.
Phenomenal.
You guys all had the wearing the black and white, and it was just so great. And Doug has this devilish grin and this smile the whole way through. He's just looking at the audience, and he's basically saying, yeah, this is it. You're seeing it. Mm-hmm. That's right. And it was just like...
Well, there was an electricity in that room.
Unbelievable.
Even more than when I saw it in 86, which was great. But that 96, there was... In the Viper room, and everybody just being in there and not being able to move. It was...
We did two nights, didn't we? Because we were playing for Rhino Records at the time.
I bow to your better memory. I don't remember that. But I do remember when you're talking about it... I think probably one of the things that lent to the attitude, the feeling that you were talking about, is we were always a club band.
Yeah.
That's, you know, when we first started, before we got our record contract, we were playing, you know, every weekend, two or three nights a week at the Troubadour, at the Starwood. And so for us to be playing a little club on Sunset, it felt like home. Mm. So I'm guessing when you saw us walking in that front door, it's because it was so natural to
us. That's what you
and
do.
And we always did pride ourselves on playing well.
Yeah. It's phenomenal.
Bruce was unbelievable. He really was. And we just basically, one of the hallmarks of our band was the musicianship we brought to the stage, brought to heel by the leadership of Doug.
Yes.
Because Doug had a very specific idea of what songs should be.
Right.
And that included contained sensible parts that that worked with one another, and that's basically the best music. I mean, I'm a lead guitarist, all my idols are guitarists, most of them. I don't want to hear a 5-minute solo.
Well, but that's true and not true. That's true and not true. But when one of the gripes you had originally, later on, was that the best solos were cut, and you ended up doing only one or two long solos, meaning because you're a great player. Remember that period?
Oh no, that was that. That's a little bit of a misinterpretation. There was one song we did. You may remember this because we began that Roxy show with this. We did Tequila Break On Through, where the first half of it is Tequila, and that's my chance to do an extended solo.
Right.
And it's really, other than Sharona, towards the end of it, really through most of our career, was the only extended solo I play on stage. Everything else was basically in the context of the song.
Right.
And at one point, I was being told we were in Japan doing the Fuji Festival. We flew to Japan for one show. And it was a great one.
In what year?
This was about 2006.
Okay. And then do you fly back the next day?
Well, but to make it really palatable, we had a gig in Hawaii on the way home.
All right.
So then I just gave myself a little vacation
in
Hawaii.
Yeah, it was worth the trip.
But I was told that, you know, some of the fans are saying, you know, like Tequila, they've heard it, and, you know, maybe we should come up with another song because that one's really long, because we do Tequila and I do an extended solo, and Presco would take a solo in it, and we do a breakdown, and then come out of it with Break On Through. And I fought it really not so much because they were cutting the length of the solo, but because it worked so well, it when it kicked into Tequila, Break On Through, It was really, it just went to 110, and it was always a great, exciting moment.
And that's Break On Through by the Doors. It was a cover of the Doors track.
Yeah, because Tequila and Break On Through has roughly the same groove, and so we thought that was funny and ironic. And
We did extensions. What I was alluding to with Burton was the fact that the improvisational factor of the musicians, that we can go off and play. I mean, Burton do bebop solos, and Lil' Cal's Big Mistake, which you soloed on live, a little more of a solo, really showed the musicianship and craft. And, and we had parts that we play because songs should have parts. And there were variations within those parts. If you listen to some of the early, even in that live album you have, some of the, like the Sharona solo you played before you decided exactly where, you know, structurally where it would go, mm-hmm. there was extended solos. And the audience, I think it also took the audience to another level because it showed them, you know, we weren't just playing parts, even though we played them perfectly.
Right.
There was a real, we had no limit musically except for the limits that were self-imposed on us.
Well, there's a rawness, definitely, in those, yeah. especially in those early live ones you guys just released. I mean, those things are, you know, to a, yeah. you know, knack nuts, like, I've never used that phrase, like Pat.
I'm going to put that on a t-shirt, though. I'm a knack nut.
A knack nut? Hey, you know, get in a time machine and sell them?
And you know what? Since Prescott just brought it up, I'm not afraid to jump around here musically. Let's hit us with a little of Little Cow's Big Mistake. This is one of Jimmy's favorites.
It is. Mm. Listen to that. This is 81? Is that when this came out?
80? Yep, 1981.
Yeah. 81.
Produced by Jack Douglas.
I still remember the whole affair, but I don't for nothing like that. After it's over, what gets you there? Do you still hang around like that? Who told you lies? Fogged up those innocent eyes. Left you with death in disguise. Guess you were bloody, but that's how you live. Now it's your turn to give. No, I do not believe that you really care.
Now, Pat, I know you like to go chronologically.
Well, we're it's okay.
Can I ask you a quick? It's your program. I don't want to step on toes.
Of course, you can ask a
quick question about it. Now, it's just coincidentally.
Oh, don't ask that.
I'm the biggest Chicago fan in the world. The band Chicago.
Yeah. Yes.
And you know, my little head exploded when I read the liner notes to Round Trip, and there's this horn section from Chicago playing on. Like I'm listening to that track, going, "This is the Knack. This is amazing." And reading it, and then there's Jimmy Pankow and Lee Locklin, yes, and Walter Perezator playing horn, and Marty Greb. Let me nerd out for a minute. How does that happen?
How is what's going through
exactly.
your mind?
why are my two worlds colliding?
When
in
we were recording that album, Chicago was recording at the same time there.
Okay.
And Doug and I, that's a really early Doug song. Predated the Knack. And I wrote the instrumental break in the middle, and we always thought of it as putting horns on it.
Mm-hmm.
And on Round Trip, we were deciding, oh, good, this is our freedom. We can start stretching out and doing different styles. And those guys were there.
Okay.
And I actually, I remember this. I wrote out, this is before I could really write sheet music that anybody could read at all. And I wrote out the parts, and they were good enough to figure out what the hell I wrote.
Right.
And we did that. And that's how they ended up.
Okay.
They were in the halls, and Jack was the kind of producer where he knew everybody. He goes, "Hey, you guys, you want to play on yeah. this?" And they said, "Sure."
Yeah, sure. All right. Well, how fortuitous then. That's fantastic.
So let me. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bern.
Oh, and another example of that is on Africa.
Yeah.
There's a sax that tails my guitar solo at one point, kind of doing answers, and that mm-hmm. was Tom Scott.
Ah, the great Tom Scott.
You know what? Let's hear a little bit of Africa.
Then
I have a question for...
Well, then play the solo, for God's sake.
For the love of God, play that
song. Preview to Africa. A lot of this influence came from myself and Burton's love of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Very nice.
We saw one of the greatest concerts ever together at the Forum.
I wasn't at that concert.
You should have been.
I hated that you saw that concert and I didn't.
I know, because we loved him. I mean, it was our sanity on the road when we were in Japan.
Prescott turned me on to Earth, Wind, and Fire. And actually, the basis of Africa, which is me playing a Fender Rhodes, mm-hmm. it was suggested by Getaway, the Earth, Wind, and Fire song.
Okay.
Right. Well, let's drop a link. I don't know.
Guitar solo, of course, is again, amazing.
I 100%
sound,
agree.
The drums are incredible. I mean,
well, you'll have to start it in the middle if you want to get to the guitar solo.
Yes.
All right.
We got to hear the beginning of that, though.
Okay. Yeah. Let's hear the beginning right from the top, and then we'll find that guitar solo. This is Africa, also from Round Trip.
That's Burton.
What is this? It sounds like
Burton and Birds.
Listen to that.
This guy's a good drummer.
Let's get some bass going.
Are you playing air keyboard, Jimmy?
Doing it all. Keyboard, bass, whatever you need me to do. Listen to that groove. I mean, you're right about Earth, Wind, and Fire. You hear it now.
Yeah, if you only know My Sharona, you got to hear this stuff.
And that's Doug doing Jim Morrison.
Doing Morrison?
He's doing Morrison.
Yeah.
the foreign sound, and you look around. Electricity.
It's got to be.
And here will come my Verdine.
Okay, Matt, I'm going to give you the honor of trying to find that guitar solo.
I'd say go in 2 minutes.
2 minutes,
from
okay.
There.
And it's such a great guitar solo. Okay.
There you are.
There
that's
it is.
Good. Oh.
Yeah, I think
that's the longest you've ever played a song on here.
I know. We have another relationship in the liner notes of Round Trip. Friend of the show, Mark Volman.
Oh, yeah, Mark Volman.
Sings,
yes.
Sings on...
How bizarre is that?
We have, it's very strange. On, like, sings on Pay the Devil.
Pay the Devil, yes.
Yeah, background vocals.
Here's what's interesting about that is I, you know, Pat said to me, you know, send me a list of songs that you want to, you know, drop in from time to time in this interview.
And the two and, we've played
two
were on
I
your played, list.
Were, they were the two. I was like, you got to play Little Cal, you got to play Africa.
Right.
And organically, they came up here.
Yeah, that's great.
That's fascinating to me.
Synchronistic.
Right?
So
right.
I want to really quick.
Sure.
That album... apart from Get the Knack, which is, has its own charm, its brilliance, its production, this album, I play for people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say who it is. Only select songs, but especially those two.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nobody knows who the fuck it is. I play the solo sections. They may say, well, maybe kind of Steely Dan is kind of this, kind of that. And when I tell them, they go, what? When did you do this? Nobody has any clue
right.
The musicianship and the potential
yeah.
To expand to that level and not and to be taken seriously.
And was that you guys or Jack Douglas, his
no,
inspiration?
That was,
that was definitely you.
I mean, no, Jack
that
brought
sound,
a lot.
That
Jack
sound.
Brought a lot to
okay.
The table.
Yeah.
But in terms of
we practiced
the
that.
Songs, mm-hmm. Again, like Prescott's alluding to, when we first did Get the Knack and But the Little Girls Understand, there was a very specific
but
kind of band we were being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we had these different influences that were ready to be drawn from. Perfect example, Little Cal's Big Mistake was a song, you know, we had that Doug had written before we ever did, you know, before there was a Knack, when Doug and I were just songwriters together.
Yeah.
You know, Pay the Devil was an early song of mine. A lot of the songs on that album, Art War,
yeah.
which I love,
right,
because it's so goofy. that was wait,
we did
no,
that
was right at the beginning. Yeah,
yeah we did
that.
At
yeah, because it's on your it's on the four track EP, isn't it? Isn't Art War?
Yes.
On it?
Yeah, it is
from before.
Right.
Get
yeah.
The Knackers released.
Right. Let me ask Prescott a question specifically about working with Jack Douglas. Was this album made? Was it made after Double Fantasy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Was Lennon still with us at that time, or had he already?
No. He had passed. Jack had two nervous breakdowns.
I was going to ask what was Jack's state while
well,
you guys were working with him?
It was called The Snows of Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess to deal with his depression, you know, he had to invest in Peruvian colonies, so to speak, and we paid for it out of our record budget. I remember one of the discussions we had was not the band budget for that, but for Jack's budget and Lee, the engineer. He was also flying back to New York at the same time between sessions. Luckily, we worked very quickly. He was working with that the guitar.
Graham Parker.
Yeah, Graham Parker.
Okay.
And plus dealing with a lawsuit with Yoko at the time.
Oh, jeez.
So when Jack was with us, I mean, he would take, you know, Bruce had tuned his drums brilliantly, but he let Jack, for each song, Jack had an idea sonically, and he'd kind of tune them. That drum sound, I mean, arguably to this day is incredible. As he did with the guitar, et cetera, he really knew how to get it. And it was well produced in every way. He didn't influence very much of the parts as much as he did the overall sound, I believe, and how to get the sounds. He was kind of like George Martin, if we can make a Beatles analogy, for that one moment. And I thought it was the best effort we've done. We really kind of did.
Excellent. Good to hear, because I was wondering if he was state of mind really present for you, or if
he was into it. He called us one of the best musical bands he ever worked with.
That's
which was
a nice compliment.
He wasn't physically present a whole lot.
Right.
I mean,
yeah,
it's like Prescott said, is at one point, we were recording out here.
Yeah.
And he said, I have to go back to New York. What?
Yeah, I thought we were working together.
And,
right.
It's because he was on contractual obligation to start Grant Parker's album by such and such a time. And Doug and I actually had to fly out to New York to finish up the record. As a matter of fact, you mentioned Mark Volman. Howie and Mark did the vocals on Pay the Devil in New York.
Didn't they do Radiant Love?
Yeah, they were probably on that, too.
They were probably
I can't remember.
Bill Hutz, one of the Hutz, Mark Hutz,
yeah.
I think.
Now, just to build on something Prescott said, if I may, Pat, very quickly.
Sure, jump in.
You know, Get the Knack, and we'll eventually talk about that, it was an album that changed my life. And I know that sounds like hyperbole, but it did.
Wow.
But then to hear, and I don't throw this word around, but I said this before these guys came in here.
Right.
Just that, Round Trip's a masterpiece. I mean, it's like, for people that don't, like you said, that think The Knack is this one-hit wonder bubblegum nonsense, listen to this.
Right.
Because this album, I got a question. Do you guys think if this album would have come out second, what do you think?
Well,
uh-oh, Prescott, you're warming them up.
Because I'm very curious, because it almost sounds, and I mean no disrespect when I say this, but the Little Girls Understand sounds like, oh, here's the songs that didn't make Get the Knack. I love it, but it sounds like that. But this sounds like, here we go.
Yeah.
This is The Knack.
And remember, these albums came out 79, 80, 81.
Yeah,
I mean, boom, boom, boom.
There was a philosophy, unfortunately, at hand. And there's a lot of stories that have changed over the years that Get the Knack was supposed to be a double album.
Are you going to dish some dirt right now?
Oh, it's bad dirt.
Okay, go ahead.
It's like off the coffin.
Go. I just touched you. Go ahead.
And me and Bird would chuckle about it at different times in our careers. Doug would tell it that Bet the Little Girls Understand should have really been a double Knack first album, which me and Burton found out.
That was news to us.
So all of a sudden you're reading some information that was never true.
We would do interviews and we'd kick each other under the table. We're going, huh?
Yeah.
Or The Origin of Sharona. That's another story.
That brings me to my next.
Wait. No. You can't say that's another story if it's not.
Oh, it is another story. But anyway, so the deal was Doug's philosophy, we're going to go from black and white to pink to color.
Ah, okay.
All right.
I guess if you want to think in those terms.
And there's some pink on the Little Girls Understand.
Yeah. Well, that's pink. The second album.
Lots of pink.
Right.
But my thing is, but the Little Girls didn't understand. and that's why it did what it did.
But let's be fair. It sold 2.5 million.
I can't be fair. Because because it was a rush job. Michael Chapman was having a nervous breakdown.
You work with a lot of producers that are having nervous breakdowns.
Well, Mike's life.
You think that there's a connection there?
Well, I didn't. I mean, Mike, but he should have taken time off.
Yeah.
Because he was going through a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't. And I think Doug superseded the role of producer, or rather took over as producer to some degree. It was a little bit of strangeness in the studio. And when I A-B the quality of Get the Knack, the vocal sound, the drum sound, the mix, and compare them, I mean, I'm just going, you got to be kidding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And even though there's some quality in the Bet the Little Girls, and the third, actually, Round Trip, comparatively, what happened with Bet the Little Girls Understand should have been the follow up. We had three more singles we could have released from Get the Knack.
Yes.
Yeah.
And sustain that, not going in the studio and re-recording it. I mean, re-recording another album, correct?
Yeah. And when you said earlier, Bet the Little Girls Understand sounded like the songs that didn't make Get the Knack. I understand why you're saying that. It wasn't necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of new songs written for But the Little Girls Understand. But it was this, good, now we have 12 songs, let's record the next album. And as I understand it, some other wiser souls say, let's keep writing. You know, let's write 25 or 30, and maybe we'll have a better 12 out of those.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, but there were songs on But the Little Girls Understand that were, again, around earlier.
Okay.
Can't Put a Price on Love, which I think is one of the better songs.
Great, it's a great song.
The most Mr. Handelman,
song of the century.
Mr. Handelman.
Mr. Which, Handelman.
Which I always liked a lot, because, again, it's totally goofy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That song predated The Knack.
Okay.
That's one of the first songs Doug and I wrote together.
Ah.
But I can understand you're saying that because the philosophy that Prescott referred to was... They know us as the Knack from Get the Knack. And it's a very distinctive personality they see us as. Let's not confuse them. Let's give them more of that. Mm-hmm. And I think absolutely, whichever one of you made the point, I totally agree. Uh-huh. If Round Trip was the second album, it would have been better.
Yeah, that was me. I want full credit.
Because
I had it written down. I just didn't get to say it.
Sure you did.
But a year later.
Because... Yeah.
Because you guys probably needed a little time to
decompress
a little bit.
We had singles. We still had singles.
Yeah.
See, we did not have... this is such an understated statement that our management was, you know, weak.
Wait, there's bad management in rock and roll?
No, it's not. It's not what you'd normally perceive as bad management.
On the other hand, Scott never stole from us. And I understand a lot of managers do that.
But he overspent. And that's like stealing.
This guy had a phone bank. This is before cell phones. Right.
Okay.
And he had an office at Crossroads of the World. And he had like 8-9 phones. As a matter of fact, I mentioned cell phones.
Who's he talking to?
Anyone.
Anyone who would call.
Anyone. Except for the people
everybody.
That were offering us business. Them he wouldn't get back to. Right. When we were on tour in 1979 on the tour bus, he had this prehistoric mobile telephone.
It was this
big honking thing. And there was no network. And what we would hear all day long, we'd be driving. Remember this? We'd be driving from Midwest City to Midwest City, and we'd hear this. Mobile operator? Mobile operator? It was like he's waiting for some signal to come in.
No, but the biggest problem was everybody underestimated the success of Sharona. And anybody with any fucking brains, there's the F word, I had to, it fits.
Well, say fuck.
Would back off and go, let's evaluate this. Mm-hmm. You can't underestimate a hit of that magnitude and just put out another album, which is Doug's philosophy. Mm-hmm. Oh, everybody just puts out second albums. Realizing the importance of what is going to be on the second album, it's going to be compared to Sharona, of course.
Yeah.
So why the hell do you treat it lightly? And Capitol, I think we're bullied into...
Rushing
release,
the second album.
Yes, especially the album cover, which is another discussion of waste and bullshit. And the inside of the album should have been the album cover.
Yeah.
With us looking
at the limousine.
Limo.
Yeah,
it was
a
real, it was a moment, you know, even though it was, you know, the girls, whatever.
But our
emotions weren't. And I really felt that should have been the cover, not what was the cover. And that was something else we'll discuss later.
That's Sharona on the cover.
Yeah, I'll tell you the origin of that photo. But you know, I'm looking back because I do a lot of interviews. I play out a lot, and people invariably ask me a lot of questions about these things. So I do think about it, and I have journals too that I would keep about moments, key moments, or you know, bad moments or good moments. And it always came up with the fact that it was just the fact that nobody really thought through the effect of putting out an album that didn't have a so-called bona fide hit, or what would be the second hit.
Mm-hmm.
What after Baby Talks Dirty, what did they pick as a follow-up single? There's my trivia question for you.
That's a great. Show me the track listing because my brain is frying. What do you got, Pat? List it through and I'll try to guess it.
Right? What was it?
Don't say it.
No, is that, what did they pick as the second single?
After
Baby Talks Dirty hit
Nowhere Land. I can't remember.
You're looking at the line.
I'm looking it up. I'm trying to find
remember?
It.
Remember? No, I guess you don't.
Tell me.
It wasn't the ballad, was it?
It was, yes.
Oh,
it was
really?
Can't Put a Price on Love.
Oh, no, Can't Put a Price on Love.
There's a 45 of it.
That's a good song.
That was actually my guess.
Yeah, but...
That would have been mine, too.
But it was the wrong one to go with because we didn't need a ballad.
Not in 80.
No.
Not in 79,
no,
80.
We were in a ballad band. Also, it was the most under... One of the greatest...
It's really underproduced.
One of the memories myself and Burton had is when Doug came back from England after mixing it with whatever the engineer had. His wife was expecting a baby or something, and they had to go to England. Were we sitting in Doug's Bentley, or were we just listening somewhere else?
Yeah.
I've never sat in a Bentley. They're telling a story about sitting in a Bentley.
Well, it was Doug's Bentley. It wasn't ours. And Burton was going, where's the guitar solo? Go, well, you're not supposed to really hear it, but it's there. Right? Was that a paraphrase?
I love those kind of explanations, don't you?
And I'd look at Brendan, well, but a guitar solo is supposed to be a guitar solo.
Well, you know what actually pissed me off about it is that, it's like it's a section where it's like it's a little four for nothing. Nothing's going on. And you kind of hear this little guitar. And I was just doing like fills.
Yeah.
It was like a Stevie Cropper kind of song, right? And I remember catching up with Mike Chapman later, and I said, what's the deal with the guitar solo? Just there's nothing there. And he goes, well, it wasn't very good.
Thank
you, Mike.
The thing that really pissed me off about that is we would work so fast in the studio that if I played something that they didn't think was any good, they would have just said, play another one.
Right.
It would take another 15 minutes. It's like they fly to New York. They fly to London to mix something that
in other words, they did an edited version later on, I think for the 45, because it was too long and they didn't need it. If that was able to be produced, I mean, Burton could be Keith Richards if he wanted, all those multiple cool hammer-on guitar lines and stuff. He could have done it. The thing could have been produced. It could have been anything. It was just left as, and I have no idea why. It was just left. Yeah. And it's a lot of those songs were underproduced.
Well, mm-hmm. I think you made a great point. I never really thought of. Is underestimating the impact and on everybody's frame of mind of a song as big as Sharona was.
Yeah.
Because at that point, you really have to think, what should we come up with next?
Yeah.
Instead of just slamming something out and, to a certain extent, more of the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And by the way, I wasn't saying that as a negative.
I understand.
That was to illustrate how great I think Round Trip is.
I think as fans, I think the general consensus sometimes is what he said about But the Little Girls Understand. We like it. It's just not Get the Knack, and it's certainly not Round Trip.
Right.
But you couldn't even, but the thing is, you couldn't put that question in the listener's head. Listeners were, critics hated us. So the listener were the only, and fans were the only allies we had.
Right.
You can't let them down.
Yeah.
And I thought we did.
Before, we've been talking about Get the Knack a lot, and when you pull out the album, you put it on side one, you drop the needle.
Here it comes.
This is what you hear.
But the production, it's hot.
We're going to hear it.
Good.
I mean, that is one of the greatest album openers.
Pat, I remember it was the summer of 79. I was between 7th and 8th grade. That's how old I was at the time. And Sharona was all over the radio.
Sure.
And the older kids in my neighborhood were already like, that song's it's overplayed. And my stepfather, who was only at the time 39 years old, brought home the album. And it was like, all right, I'll play it, Ron. I'll play it to make, I'll listen to your Knack album.
We'll bond with my stepdad.
Right? And then that hits me. And that's what I said earlier, it changed my life. This is, and by the way, I was on a TV show called The List once on VH1. And I was on their panel talking about, and the topic was best pop album of all time. And I said, Get the Knack.
Right. Thank you.
Everybody looked at me like I was nuts because they were all saying The Doors and Zeppelin and other things, which to me wasn't a pop album.
The people that say that, they haven't heard the album.
They don't know it.
They haven't heard it.
But I said, I didn't go to bat, but I was like, this album, it's what a pop album is. It's when you use the word pop, this is it. This is for 3 to 4 minute songs that just punch you in the fucking face. And so this thing, I overplayed this. I brought it to every school dance. They all wanted to play, which I love, Journey and, Lights and City of the Angels. That would play.
I didn't know you were going to sing today. If I knew that, I would have.
Yeah, we'll clear that with.
Let's jump to Frustrated.
Oh,
that should have been a single.
Yes.
Well, I mean, that should have been. I mean, it all should.
The whole, like you said, Prescott,
there could have been three more singles.
I'll give you an amendment to that story after. Do you want to play anyway?
Yeah, go ahead. Frustrated.
Tonight, but you know she'll turn it off just as you're turning out the light. Frustrated, you do it.
Even as a kid, before I really was like knew too much about sex, I knew, hey, I think this guy's singing about some naughty stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jimmy was talking about 3 to 4 minute pop songs. My Sharona is actually 4 minutes and 54 seconds. Yeah, was there any talk at the label to shorten that?
They made an edit.
Yeah, the single Top 40 was the, of course, the solo.
The solo's gone, right?
Yeah.
They did a really good job. We did a really good job with the edit, though. I was totally in favor of that. I got it.
Yeah.
You know.
But then, but it's also BS because, you know, what started with Like a Rolling Stone or whatever, there were songs that did exceed the limit. If some ballads would go on forever later on. I think they did that, whatever reason it was. You know, then here goes another situation.
It's hard, too, when they edit it and it becomes what it is. It's like, well, I guess it worked. It's hard to say.
Well, some stations, FM stations, definitely.
Oh, yeah. The version. Mm-hmm. I think you heard the full version more than the
I think you did,
one.
Too.
But that again, the problem was the album came out without a single. Believe it or not, Capitol in their wisdom did not pick a single.
And so how did they stumble into this one?
Well, because they put it on radio. We were in Europe at the time. Mm-hmm. And immediately the response, listener response, went through the roof for
the
Sharona.
The programmers, yeah.
How did you not know that would be the obvious pick?
You know, with one of the greatest hooks in rock history.
So they had a Capitol Records doesn't know it.
So they had to do a rush release of Sharona after the album was already, going up to charts. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's it. So they actually heard the long version first.
You're right.
There was no edited version, correct?
That's right. They had a rationale that they weren't as dumb as it sounds.
Well,
it's basically they said, look, Sharona's the song. And Sharona, from the first time when we wrote that song and brought it in, the first time we ever performed it at the Troubadour, everybody in the room knew that's the song.
Yeah.
That's it. And Capitol knew it too.
Yeah.
But at the time they said there's not hard rock on Top 40 radio.
Hmm.
And we kind of, being kids of the 60s, we went, "Hur?" But at that time, for a very brief moment in our careers, we didn't want to make waves.
Right.
And so, whatever you guys best, right?
Yeah.
But what happened, what we were told later on by our promo guys, is they would go into the FM stations and say, this is this new band. And the guy would put the needle on Sharona and like 10 seconds later says, this is going on. It was just, it was a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I was doing this interview with a guy on a Cleveland FM station once, and he said that the first time he played it, like, again, 20, 30 seconds into the song, his phone boards lit up like a Christmas tree.
Wow.
And he said the only other song that ever happened to like that was More Than a Feeling.
Oh, that makes sense.
That makes sense.
Was a pretty good song.
It's another good song.
Another good song.
The cover of Get the Knack.
Okay.
The cover of Get the Knack, which we both have signed and hanging in
framed
our offices.
And signed on our offices.
Like nerds.
Oh, wow.
But we have a story about the signing of that in 1 second. It's just such a... You see that cover and you're like, what is this? Makes you feel good.
Robert Hilburn said, saw Meet the Beatles. That's the only thing he saw.
Hilburn tried to kill us. He tried... I'm telling you, he tried to take a knife to our throat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not making this up. When Get the Knack came out, this is how we reviewed it. Front page of the entertainment section. He's got a picture.
This is a stupid rock critic, is what we were talking about.
Local rock critic in LA.
Yeah.
Not quite to the heights of legendary status, which they get.
Right. Well, okay.
Now.
I'm not making any of this up or exaggerating.
We believe you.
He puts a picture of Meet the Beatles and a picture of Get the Knack right next to each other. Like these guys are trying to be this. So right away you hate us, right? right away, who the fuck do these guys think they
instead
are?
Instead of Mitha, it's Getha, like everything.
Right.
Because back then, there was nothing like an homage, and even though if it was or if it wasn't, no one thought like that back then.
The picture on the back cover was an homage.
Yes.
It was a tongue-in-cheek. Can you believe how stupid a young band would be to try to be the Beatles?
Yes,
that's exactly what that picture was saying.
But it wasn't Capitol. It was all, keep going.
So anyway,
Doug. Okay.
In the first paragraph, he describes our music as for a 13-year-old's taste, so any 18-year-old kid who's never heard us hating us, really hating us by now. At which point you turn off of the front page to this page 6 where he starts describing the songs. Well, this song's pretty great. Well, this song's great. Good Girls Don't. That could be. You could have maybe said that the part, but he made sure he got in all the stuff that would kill us.
Yeah.
That's basically how the critics
responded
to us.
The problem is, the hierarchy of the Knack would give the enemy the bullets to shoot at us all the time. Doug's love of the Beatles, which we all shared, going to Capitol Records, having the logo, blah, 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 and the back cover being what it was, the front cover, which consciously or subconsciously being the cover. Yes, there were Beatle influences, but again, you hear it, the drumming.
That's not
the
Beatles.
The rhythmic, except maybe Tonight, of course, which is okay to have one song. But it was so un-Beatle-esque, everything about
it. Absolutely.
And that's the so we gave everybody the illusion we were trying to be the Beatles, but the music were not the Beatles. We kind of gave all the critics the reason to not like
us.
In reality, if they really looked at it objectively, which I guess we didn't at the time because of what the clues we put out there, then maybe it would have been more accepted. But the fact that they reduced us to 13-year-olds was just a way to put it down because, again, the thing about Sharona is the great thing about it because I've heard my kids play it. It's a long story. We'll get to that later. When you hear it, it sounds fresh. It's just rock and roll. You can't date the song because it just sounds like it could have been recorded yesterday.
Absolutely.
And that's the beauty of the song.
Let's hear it. Drop us in.
That's enough. We all get it. It's my Sharona.
I know.
Which has, safe to say, top 5 guitar solos of all time.
I say
this without the gentleman in the room. You hear me?
And the rhythm section on this thing.
When you're gonna give me some time, Sharona, we'll make my motor up. My motor up.
Matt, jump to 2:44.
We're not gonna hear there. What are we gonna hear?
I don't know.
He's got it committed to memory.
I know.
Burden pontificating.
So all this Beatles stuff comes out, and then you get Sharona, which is number one for 6 weeks, and then it's the fastest sold debut single since the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. So there's more.
I want to hold your hand. So now there's more comparison.
And I'm curious, though, you alluded to this earlier, Prescott, about Sharona, that maybe the backstory isn't as true as that we read. Is that it's not about the real estate lady? It is?
It is about the real estate.
It is, okay.
That part is true.
All right.
It's unbelievable. You know, to this day, to this day, I did a gig with somebody. I was back east, right, and I get a cab, and the guy goes, you know, whatever, and we knew the knack. So he says, so what's the song about? I go, what do you mean? What's Sharona about? What's a Sharona?
What's a Sharona?
And what's a Sharona?
Well, I didn't want to tell you this, guys, but it's the kind of thing that girls use, like, to get off. It's kind of like a, kind of vibrates. And he goes, oh.
The wiser guy singing the song.
Yeah, yeah. So in other words, I can make up any stupid reason. A lot. It's so obvious, maybe because Sharona is a very popular name in Israel. It's Sharon.
Yeah.
And, but still, I think even the song, adding to the legend of the song, the misinterpretation of the lyric or the not knowing what the lyric meant gave it another quality, mm-hmm. which is...
kind of like Louie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We all assumed those were dirty lyrics.
Because, we all knew what it was about.
And they weren't.
One of the greatest things, and I can't find it on YouTube, is when Steve Allen, remember?
Yes.
I can't find it. Read the lyric like he did with
Steve
Allen.
He revived in the 50s. Steve Allen did this thing where he recited the lyrics to Get a Job.
Okay. And bebop a little bit too, right?
Like, mum, 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 dip, 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 get a job. And one of my proudest moments is he was on something like Music Scene, one of those shows, and he did it. He reprised that bit for Sharona.
For Sharona. Oh, that's excellent.
Ooh, my little pretty one. Actually, the difference between the story of how the song was written and the way the story is actually written is not – the difference is actually fairly slight.
Uh-huh.
Is the way the song was written is I came up with the riff. Mm-hmm. And I brought
I have the rehearsal tape.
Where I came in to the rehearsal, and I started playing this riff.
Uh-huh.
And
which
Doug
was different.
Says, oh, that's cool. And I mentioned to Bruce that I didn't imagine it like regular, like hi-hat, snare. It was more like a tom-tom kind of thing, like a jungle beat.
Yeah.
And we just jammed on it, and Doug was like scat singing over it. He says, that's great. Let's go home and write it. And we went back to his apartment and wrote it.
Okay.
And over the years, Doug just got messed up on the chronology, and he said
really?
That he had he remembered having had that riff for what he said a couple years before we ended up writing it. And I know that's just virtually impossible because I know the song that inspired me to write the riff.
Right.
So, it you know.
Which is, do you mind sharing that? What was the song?
Pump It Up.
Of course.
Pump It Up. The it just the energy of Pump It Up and the breakdown.
Uh-huh. Pump It Up by Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was
excellent.
Like,
it was
that
sing
album.
Sing to him the real riff that you had.
Hmm?
It was sing the variation of the riff you had originally. It was different.
Oh, yeah?
When you brought
some
it
extra
in.
Notes?
Yeah, it was different.
Oh. We always play too much. League of Stars. We always play too much. Less notes, Mr.
And I was doing this funk thing to it.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course you were.
Of course, I was black.
Of course you were.
But I wish I had the – you can see it. And Doug's scat singing. And he had the middle section, too, a little bit of the da-dum, ba-dum, a little bit of that. So – we were doing an interview in Washington for this TV show, and I'm sitting next to Burton. And Doug is going, well, you know, Burton had this riff, and, well, I kind of thought it was okay, but I didn't think it was the right time
yeah,
to
didn't
do
think it.
It
was the right time.
And one day, we were sitting there, I had this thing, and I started to play it on my legs, and I kicked Burton on it. We like looked at each other, oh, God, here we go again. And I had another origin story of, well, when it was the right time, we figured we should do it, and I had this beat that I told, he was just right. Like, oh, God.
Right. So it's that friend you have where you're like, we love him, and he's amazing, but here he goes again. That type
well,
of a thing.
Well, it was okay at that point. But and then Bruce had his own story about it.
Sure.
And again, the beginning sounds like a little bit like going to a go-go, right? The drum beats.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I've played that song with many drummers, many people attempting to play mm-hmm. it. The only people that can play it well are my kids. That's a later story. I don't want to interrupt the flow here. Mm-hmm. I just did it at the Rock and Roll Autograph Show. Mm-hmm. Most people say they can play it. They can't play mm-hmm. it. They can't do the drum part right. They don't flam right. They don't feel right. The guitar solo, I kind of know it. No, you can't kind of know it.
Right.
You either play the notes or you don't. The arrangement is quirky. So every time people think they know the arrangement, they always – and I've done this with the Classic Rock All-Stars and other people I play with. They always fucking blow it. I don't even want to play it anymore.
Yeah.
But the thing about that song is it was one take. Bruce I re-listen to these things, obviously, because I'm bored. I drive all around. the drumming, it's like whatever Bruce created at the beginning, and every time we go back to the riff, you know, you can recut a song 10 times, like a lot of groups will never do one takes. They, you know, technically they didn't do it or the feel. It's amazing about that song is every time it goes back to it, it's the same, I had to do with sexuality. It's got the same feel to it. And you can't teach that. You can't even produce it on a drum machine. It's got, even when Bruce would speed up usually in choruses or things from extra dynamics. But when he brought it back in, like on Selfish 2, the drum beat is incredible. And that groove, so that was one take. And, and you know, Mike would go, okay, now, great, come on in.
Got it.
And he loved it. I mean, Blondie would take a month to get Heart of Glass.
That was actually the only, when we recorded that album, that was the only solo that I did, that I think.
Did a couple of passes on
it. Actually, it was one pass, and I stopped towards the end.
Right.
I said, oh, I screwed up. They said, no, you didn't. I said, well, then keep it rolling. Everything else on Get the Neck, we just played live. Well, we played everything live when we recorded it in, like we were playing in the Troubadour,
right?
Which is what Chapman said. He says, my idea of recording you guys is just to bring you in and have you play like you're in a club. We'll just start the tape.
Yeah.
And like the solo in Let Me Out, all those were, I was just playing like live. You can hear my guitar actually drops out to play the solo. And Mike, again, it's like what Prescott was saying, is they're probably used to people who weren't as well rehearsed.
Right.
Not to cast aspersions on any other particular bands, but we really were well rehearsed. And actually, I'll never forget when we did Let Me Out, and he wanted me to double the guitar solo, because you double sometimes just for tone. Basically, it gives it a thicker tone, right? And I knew that he didn't know that I had that solo to memory. It wasn't just riffing.
Right.
And there's a pretty quick riff in the middle of it, and I just nailed it first time. And I walked in, and he's just poker face, and I just said, I allowed myself my one moment of pride. I said, I'll bet you didn't think I was going to get in one, did you? And the Aussie that he was, he goes, nope. No, I didn't.
Now, again, this is Mike Chapman, who also produced Blondie and Sweet and countless Lita Ford, countless
Goldie, people. Susie Quattro,
yep,
Chris
Susie
Norman.
Quattro,
and Blondie was recording down the hall their first album when we were in Whitney Studios doing ours. Of course, we were in there in 2 weeks and out. They were still working on a Heart of Glass for a month because they had to layer their drum track, etc. Mike Chapman, you know, in one of my journal quotes, Mike, when he came in, said, number one, Sharona, number one. That's it. And I remember writing, okay, Mike, I believe you. You're right. And, of course, he was right. Mm-hmm. He damn well knew it. First time he heard it, he said, number one. If you listen to that live album, the drum part changes when you really listen to it. It doesn't play the groove throughout. It goes to a hi-hat pattern.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. It goes all over the place. Huh. It doesn't play it because that was really early.
See, I don't listen to our old stuff.
No,
that's what I need him for.
What's great about this is I kind of thought they're probably sick of talking about Sharona, so we'll get it out of the way. And I love that you guys are really, really passionate about the recording and the process and everything that's involved in not just that song, but all these songs.
Well, you know, it's
because you know
when you have a song that has that kind of impact.
Yeah.
And it actually comes back to a later generation in Reality Bites.
Right.
And then a later generation, they keep using it in commercials and movies, and people still refer to it and know it and want to hear it. It's an honor.
Yeah.
And so it's not something to shrug off, you know. It's like I make a sports analogy. Jamal Wilkes was a UCLA basketball player. And then as a rookie, he was on the Golden State Warriors. And his team won the championship when he was a rookie. And he happened to have got some more championships down the way with the Lakers.
Yeah.
But let's say for the sake of argument, that was the only championship he ever won. Would anyone ever come up to him and say, you only got one?
No, no one would.
We got the ring.
And every band would want to have
A Sharona.
Well, if you really know what Sharona was in terms of musicality, the thing for me is I play around a lot. And I play with different people, and everybody wants to hear it, or I've played it with people, and
not the same.
No, yeah, that's true. But the fact that, in a way, because of my participation, it has a new life,
right?
And it becomes relevant and current,
yeah.
As opposed, because I just did it for this Rock and Roll Autograph Show a few weeks ago, And I actually have it on YouTube with my kids playing it. And you'd be
so proud of it. It's on YouTube?
Yeah, you'd
be so proud of it. The autograph for the show. Was that?
It was underdone, but it was good because I got to play with a lot of very. I play with the drummer of Chicago.
Seraphim was there, yeah.
Yeah, that's his name,
Danny Seraphim.
I played with him, and I was jamming with him, Dick Wagner, Mark Farmer.
Yeah, Grand Funk.
So a lot of times I'm asked to either play it or whatever. So it becomes current. And what I realize is each person I play with or attempt to play with, like I said before, they undervalue it because they don't play it right. Mm. And you can't fake that. No. It's not, taking care of business or you just play some chords.
Right.
There's particular things to it, especially the drums. If the drums aren't right, the song doesn't work.
How did Danny do? How did Serafini do with this? With it?
No.
He didn't play this. I
played it with my kids.
Gotcha.
No, Dan, we were jamming on just blues stuff.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? And I also played Get Ready for Here I Come with a drummer from,
Rare Earth.
Yeah, I played with him.
Before we move off of Sharon, I have to share. You're playing the song. You say go up to 244, and I'm guessing he's going to the solo.
Right.
The solo starts. I glance over at Prescott. And he's checking his messages.
Yeah.
It was such a bass player thing to do. You know? It's like, oh, God. Here, he's starting to wank, man. It's gone.
Actually, there's other alerts that I have to, nursing home stuff that I have to.
Oh.
So it's not just me. Because I'm a champion. I'm one of the few people that...
No, he did. When I talked to him on the phone, he's like, it's going to be embarrassing for me to be in the room with Burton and praising
compliment him.
Compliment him.
Oh, I guess he's gotten used to it. Yeah, well, I can understand that. I make it hard.
You do. But wait, one more thing.
Sure.
There's something called confirmed bias. You know what that means, psychological term?
Mm-mm.
Where if you have a bias against something, you'll use anything to confirm it.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that Get the Knack is not even in the 500 of Rolling Stone or other publications.
That is ridiculous.
Okay. It's a confirmed bias. And sometimes even in the culture, it's dismissed as if we're one hit band, whatever the hell the thing is, because people assume that the sound bites that put us down as something never even gave a damn to listen. I work at a company called Taxi Music where I critique songwriters all the time, which means when I listen to stuff I've done in the past, the Knack, I re-critique the songs as pretending somebody sent them in. And the songs that are great that I always love, I still love because they're really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when I listen to Get the Knack objectively, and I'm going, gee, every song is not only really good, it's played, but it's brilliant. And for what it is, and it's different than everybody else.
Yeah.
And it gives me a new appreciation and pride in it. So when people don't even list it in their top list, it really pisses me off.
Yeah.
That's confirmed bias.
As a fan, it pisses me off too.
What balances it out for me, because I try not to get, Prescott was totally accurate. From the beginning, the critics hated us. I just got used to
reading. Well, there was reason why they hated us, because Doug gave them ammunition.
But so let me ask you, alluding back to those times, there's a lot of to-do about how you guys didn't do interviews back in those days. What was the reason to not do the interviews?
There was an official reason, and there was the real reason.
Okay, drop them both on us.
The official reason was, we were hearkening back to a time before rock and roll was so overblown and people were just big and iconic right away and everybody wanted to hear from them. We were thinking, we've had one album, we're a working band, you know. The real reason was Doug had put his foot in his mouth a couple times.
Okay.
Yeah. And basically, he was a little bit of a loose cannon in an interview, and so it was better not to lend the ammo. Yeah.
But in retrospect, was it better? Because, critics then would go, these guys won't even talk to us.
No. Well, I really, honestly, guy, when I heard that one that, they hated us now because we weren't allowing them to do their jobs because we were the big, well, how much do you really learn from an interview with a guy?
We gave interviews. We were really, really good. There was a humor. Doug, Burton, myself, and Bruce to a certain degree were very intelligent. And Bruce had his expertise. We could be funny, lyrically satirical. Burton and Doug could launch into songs on Broadway songs and sing them, which they often did, because they knew music history.
Yeah.
And they were intelligent. They knew about the world. They knew about history. All of us did.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't idiots getting up there and going, I fucked four broads last night, man. I'm cool. we were a different kind of, and I will compare it to the Beatles, only to the degree we were humorous. We could be satirical, we could be, you know, off the cuff and get away with it.
And self-deprecating, for that matter.
And self-deprecating, which was, actually, we could have sold ourselves. Dick Clark wanted to do a movie with us. I don't know if you knew this.
No, I did not know this.
Well, I didn't know that. When I don't know anything.
When Dick Clark passed away, I wanted to write on Facebook on, we probably have the distinction as the only people that not only did not do American Bandstand, which is incredible to believe, but probably didn't get back to Dick on a script idea and turned him down, which shows you the arbitrariness and the insanity of the decision-making at the time.
Well, Scott was buying more phones.
Well, right, yes. But he needed more money to buy other phones. I mean, we would do interviews in Europe. We did TV in Europe. Mm-hmm. We turned down Fridays, right? Mm-hmm. We turned down Mork and Mindy. We turned down these shows.
You didn't go to the Grammys.
Well, that is the biggest thing.
Oh, we were in Japan.
No, yeah.
No, we were. We were in Japan.
Yeah, but
we
know why.
Happened.
Because we turned down going to the Grammys to go to Japan for an ill-fated second tour.
That's right.
Where
there were
no people
there.
Going to the shows because they were taking exams. People were sick. It was fucking snowing in Sapporo.
Students were committing suicide.
I almost did. We were playing in Sapporo, Japan, the night of the Grammys. Okay? I mean, how many bands have the honor to let alone be invited to have two nominations? Yeah. If we had played Sharona live and kissed ass and done the things that people should do in gratitude to the business to get in the door, we could have sold another 10 million records. I mean, easily. Because we would perform it live and we would have blown people away.
No question about it.
Okay. So we're in Japan for a tour we shouldn't have done because there was no audience. We had been there already a few months earlier. And unfortunately, we were promoting a second album that was falling off the charts. We got there, it was charting, it was falling backwards. It was the worst thing you could ever do, and we pissed off the promoters as well, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
But so,
what'd you do to piss off the promoters?
Well, that's later. Well,
all right.
But Scott did. But the bottom line is, we had the opportunity to present ourselves to America.
Right.
That wasn't good enough. We turned down opportunities to do TV, which I guess we, instead of just playing on Saturday Night Live, I guess Friday nights, whatever, apparently the rumor was we wanted to co-host. Is that true?
Yes. Well, that's what I heard.
From manager.
Which was ridiculous.
So in other words, to not do American Bandstand and have Dick Clark, who was a fan, I cry when they have these, like, and I really do.
Yeah.
When they have American Bandstand, all the great people, and all these other shows that people have been on, I kill, or Friday, or Don Kirshner's thing, right? Doug didn't like Don Kirshner, didn't like the thing. Everybody did it, and we would have been immortalized as great band, great musicians. And we turn all that shit
now,
down.
Now, at the time, do you know this, or is it, or you're young?
I
you
knew
don't?
It. Oh, I, yeah. we thought about it.
You did?
Yeah.
When we knew about it, when we were not censored.
Don't fight about it today, guys.
Yeah, no, no.
Well,
he
they're
didn't,
on
he
the same
didn't,
side.
He didn't mean me and Prescott felt. He said that we
I know.
Would say as a band, wait, why are we doing this?
Gotcha.
And it just basically, there was a party line. You
yeah.
know? And you know,
and we knew it in our souls it was wrong.
Yeah, yeah, but speaking for only myself, I'm not the kind of person that butts down doors. So I'm not the kind of person who says, I should be the leader or I should have, you know. And so when I was told this is the way it's going to be, I figured, okay, I'll be a team player.
Right.
And, you know, things have gone well and let's continue to do that. Now, getting back to the public perception or the God knows the journalistic perception. Right. The thing that has always balanced that out for me over the years is every once in a while, the name of the song will come up in the mouths of people that I revere. You know, not too long ago, somebody sent me an email and said, "Check this out." There was somebody that was on a British radio show, and it was a desert island. Like, what song? What records will you take it? And one of the songs he mentioned, he made a point of mentioning, was My Sharona, Ray Davies.
Yeah. I love Ray Davies.
Yes, you do.
And,
that is a compliment.
And
that
so
is.
When you hear that, you go, okay, right. That just wipes out all
everything,
of those,
yeah.
those the B-minus, you know, state college journalism dropouts that wrote, you know.
But they liked us. A lot of the college people liked us. Yeah. It was, we snubbed when we played New York. And we did a brilliant show at Carnegie Hall, right? So what do we do at the end of the show before doing A Hard Day's Night? Remember Doug's speech? He quoted Dylan, "The times they are a changing."
Oh.
And there was a line about critics and
something. Oh, yeah. Oh, nice.
And now, with all the Beatles comparison, why would you choose to do Hard Day's Night?
That's why.
And just fun.
For two reasons.
Throwing it in your face.
Yeah. For two reasons. That's one reason, because it's kind of funny that a band which is being pilloried for something we didn't do.
Exactly.
We end the show at Carnegie Hall with a Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
And the second is we were a loving cover band. We loved doing faithful covers,
and we do covers in
of our heroes. Hard Day's Night is one. We did a great version of Come On Everybody, which was a
incredible
Eddie Cochran song.
It was great.
Yeah, we did earlier. We would do "And Your Bird Can Sing" at the Troubadour. You know,
we did that. We also did "Jay and the Americans."
Come a little bit closer. Was
come
one of
a little. Oh, that, actually, you guys did that when I saw you.
That was one of our most beloved covers.
We did "Not Fade Away" sometimes.
Oh, "Not Fade Away." We did "Not Fade Away" / "Mona," which is the song we played when Springsteen jammed with us at the Troubadour.
You know what? You talked about Ray Davies. You're talking about covers, Matt. Let's hear a little bit of "The Hard Way."
Good segue.
You're gonna find out the hard way. You're gonna find out the hard way. No matter what I do or say, you must have gone to educate. One day life's gonna turn around, slap in the face. You're gonna find out the hard way. You can take the hard way. Well, you do.
So we just listened to "The Hard Way." That's your cover of the Kinks song, written by Ray Davies. Amazing cover. I love the song.
It was great.
I love what you guys did to it. I love it just as much
as
the original.
And Doug delivered it beautifully on stage.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So now you, Prescott, you have a story about "My Baby Talks Dirty."
Wasn't my baby, but I'll tell it anyway. First of all, when
that's
we started
literally
to do
true.
It,
it's "Baby Talks Dirty."
Yeah, yeah. I like the riff, and parts of it. I knew it would be compared to Sharona, which was wrong. Because it was riff-based. The song, the structure, had nothing to do with it, okay? When I heard the lyric, you know, my baby said, hurt me, and then the panting, you know, I mean, that's what I do when I go to the bathroom. I pant like that. However,
I don't know
if
what you're
Steven,
doing
now, here's my thing. If Steven Tyler wanted to sing that,
right.
If some of the other people that were sexually oriented in their persona on stage, it would work. Doug talking about my baby said, hurt me. I knew, now, that before that, people were saying the band was misogynist. Remember?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That the lyrics and we were putting down women, whatever the hell it was. So I was against the lyric because, A, it wasn't a particularly good lyric. It was about hurting, licky, sticky, you know, all these dumb fucking rhymes. I didn't think it was appropriate. I know we were supposed to be the Beatles and the Stones, correct? I mean, the good boys, bad boys kind of thing. I just didn't think it was appropriate because Doug's not Steven Tyler or people that could get away, or Rod Stewart, where people can get away with it. I knew people would object. I had this argument with Scott on the tour bus. I said, it's not going to work. People are not going to like this. I'm telling you, blah, blah, blah. You know, when it came out, it was barred in England.
Really?
They wouldn't play it because of the lyric.
Wow.
Really?
And we're talking 1980.
And I researched it. It was true. Stations would not play it because of the lyric.
Yeah.
So was I right? Yes. Did it matter? No. So that's my point. And I didn't think the song, I knew it would be compared to Sharona, unfairly so, but that was a single.
What, do you think there was a better single off that album then?
No. I think this better single was yet to be written.
Gotcha.
And they were on round trip.
Yeah. I liked "I Want You." That was a very good song.
That's a great song.
But again, it wasn't even released. So that's kind of where things were headed at the time, where I think success became a pass to do what you want to do. Do what thou want. Even though the other band members may object to it.
Right.
I want to move us into 10 years after Round Trip. But before I do, when you guys are starting out, you're in the club scene on the Sunset Strip.
And by the way, 10 years after, one of the few bands we didn't cover.
Exactly.
You guys are on the Sunset Strip. You're playing the Troubadour. Just give us a little taste of who's in the audience.
Well,
Because everyone was coming out to see the Knack, musicians.
Girls, baby.
Yeah, we it was great.
But you attracted some...
There were a lot of teenage girls that would come see our show.
Right.
And that really helped the word of mouth of bringing more crowds.
Right.
Basically. And it really was... It was great. It was organic. It wasn't fake. For once, it really was. It was this groundswell where the next week we'd play, there'd be a bigger crowd.
Yeah.
And the next week, it would grow exponentially. Okay. And when you asked who was in the crowd, I thought you were referring to some of the people that played with us. And I don't know who was in the crowd, but basically...
But I'm like Springsteen and Tom Petty, and these guys would come see
Petty
you.
Yeah, with us at the tree.
Yeah.
And at the Starwood, didn't he, with any money?
Yeah, Eddie Money played with us. I remember Eddie Money played with us. We did two tickets to Paradise, and I did this riff that the guitarist does at the end of the solo.
Yeah.
And Money kind of looked at me like, hey, you got that.
Yeah.
But that's what we do.
You know? Yeah, man. We know what we're doing.
It was good.
The first one we did was Ray Manzarek, the keyboard player from The Doors, the late, great Ray Manzarek.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this surreal moment because we did two songs with him. We did Love Me Two Times and...
We did three.
We did Love Me Two Times, Soul Kitchen, and Whiskey Bar, with Alabama song, which is a Kurt Vile song.
Right.
And this will happen. It had been so long since he played it. He was kind of fuzzy on the chord structure, and I was actually showing the chords of Whiskey Bar to Ray Manzarek and thinking, this is wrong.
Yes,
this is
amazing.
Weird.
So what was I saying? Oh, okay. So Round Trip is 1981, and then you guys do a tour for this. And then what happens? The band just kind of...
We broke up.
You just broke up.
Yeah.
We had broken up before Round Trip.
Okay.
And if it was not for John Lennon's unfortunate tragic death, we were not... See, we were having a party. We were going to have a party celebrating the fact that Doug went his way. We were going to reform a new band.
Right.
Remember? Mm-hmm. So I thought we were going to call that party Dugout. I thought we were going to call the album Dugout. Then we got revelations that our manager... alienated everybody on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
So then the party ended up, because of Lennon's death, ended up being a scot-free party.
Mm.
Meaning, we got, remember at your house?
Yes,
party,
yes.
We're all going to get back together. You know, we grieved together, and that's when we decided we're going to do a third album. And we talked about producers, and Jack Douglas's name came up. And it was really a good time for all of us. I thought emotionally we're connected. Of course... You know, within that scope, it changed after where we did. Bruce quit actually.
Yeah.
Afterwards, but that was a really good time emotionally. I thought, right? Were we more connected, maybe for a minute?
Yeah, we were. I think what happened is that we were in such shell shock with the response after the second album, and the fact that we had, you know, our name had become a joke. I mean, basically, people had piled on, and it was stunning, and we didn't really know what to do about it. And this was a chance to try to do it right. And by Round Trip, it was too late. It really was. I mean, we didn't get much of a chance.
Right.
You know, I remember we had this luncheon with the heads of Capitol at, you know, an Italian restaurant in Melrose, and we're sitting at this big long table, and the suggested meaning of the luncheon was, this is to show you guys we're still behind you.
Yeah.
And we walked out of that room saying, we're fucked. They're gone. They are not.
But they wanted us to tour South America, I remember, which would have been a good idea, actually.
They would have said Antarctica if they could have gotten us
anything to get rid of, yeah.
Well, a lot to do with, again, we alienated Capitol on the second album.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. Because the cover, really quickly, 20 seconds, it's not, this is, I'm trying to balance positive and negative, but that cover, that picture of Sharona. Come on.
That
picture,
really?
Picture of Sharona. Maybe I've been waiting a long time to get something.
Yeah, yeah, here we go.
That
go ahead.
Picture, the album cover. That photo was taken in the Starwood when Sharona was looking at the stage.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Doug thought that picture was iconic, meaning that typified the young girl looking at her idol.
Okay.
That microphone stand and stage was superimposed. They had to take a shot of that microphone and glitter it and superimpose it with
that
Sharona.
Is cool.
It cost a lot of money at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Art department was pissed off, right? Even though we recorded the album for nothing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when you look at it, it's schlock. It's like, it does, nobody got it. We should have been on the album cover.
Yeah.
And that's why the insert would have been a great album cover.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the album cover. Sharona was already on the single. Doug liked to have his girlfriends on sleeves, like Baby Talks Dirty had his other girlfriend on
Abby.
Abby. So I thought that was a little too personal.
Yeah.
And the band should have been on, and there should have been another picture rather than get the Knack picture.
Is the girl on the cover of Serious Fun, is that Doug's girlfriend?
No.
We all wanted her.
Don't go there.
So Serious Fun comes out. It's 10 years after Round Trip, 1991. I don't know what you guys do. What do you guys do for that 10 years?
We had broken up as a band.
Right.
We put our own band together.
Prescott and I and Bruce had put our own band together. It didn't work out. We tried something else.
We had an actor singer.
Steven
Bauer.
That didn't work out.
Steve Bauer?
Scarface. Yeah.
He was singing.
Yeah. And did you guys do something with Michael DeBar, too? Is that true?
We
did a session for him.
Remember? Oh, yeah, sure. That's right.
Holly Knight.
Oh,
cool. We did a session.
And
Stephen Bauer looked great, and if we did a video, we would have sold a million.
Yeah,
our manager was arrested for cocaine trafficking.
That's true.
And prostitution, so we couldn't get there.
That's part of the positive.
Yes, it is. So Serious Fun, how does that get together?
Well, we got back together in about 86, 87. There was a day in about 84, 85 where Doug called me up, and we hadn't spoken for a while.
Right.
And he said, "Bertie, I want to come by."
Sure.
And he came by, and Doug did great work in the program, and he got clean and sober, and
he was
clean and sober the rest of his life.
Excellent.
And it was his amends day.
Okay.
You know, and so for me, it cleared away a lot of emotional, personal shit. And so there was no reason not to start working together again.
Right.
And so we were working together. We were considering doing different kind of projects.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we just bowed to the obvious and inevitable.
The Knack.
Just do the Knack again, you know. And there was serious friction between Doug and Bruce. There always was.
Okay.
And that never quite went away. And when we got back together as the four of us, it just wasn't going to work. Prescott and I would defend Bruce and inevitably finally say, "No, you're right. He's just a pain in the ass. It's not worth it." And so we had for a while Pat Torpey, who ended up being our drummer in our live days in the last 4 or 5 years we gigged as a band.
Right. From Mr. Big.
Left us to play with Mr. Big.
Well, actually, he left us to play Robert Plant's tour. If you remember that.
Well, that sounds like a mistake. Why would you do that?
Yeah, really.
Well,
talk about punching down.
We had some songs. We did it. We were trying to get a deal with Manhattan Records. We had a different manager at the time. He had a serious acne problem. However, that wasn't the... But he ended up...
Another positive.
He ended up managing Fiona Apple, who's brilliant.
I did not know that. Not that she's brilliant, but that he managed her.
Yeah, I didn't know he had acne problem.
Anyway, we had the material wasn't strong enough, long story. But Doug was friends with Don Was... And Don wanted to get on board. Burton and Doug wrote some great songs, more experimental. You know, Burton did a couple of different things. I felt musically, right?
Yeah.
Did that a cappella thing.
Mm-hmm.
We did. And the guitar and the playing, Billy Ward was not Bruce Gary, but he was pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he plays great on that album. Rocket of Love, again, was a damn good single.
Good song.
They didn't cross it over to A&M, which they should have.
AM
radio.
Sorry.
Yes.
They should have. That was a great single, and it did chart FM-wise. We went with Charisma.
Charisma.
Part of Chrysalis. They didn't understand it. We didn't get a video until it was too late.
I think they were part of Virgin.
They weren't. Well, maybe. Yeah, I don't know what that
means. Well, now they're no more.
Yeah.
But we almost had it. They didn't promote it right. We didn't have a video. And unfortunately, that was a great song, and there's a better song even. We didn't get to the One Day at a Time ballad, and unfortunately, that album ended up being what it became. But it's really, really good.
Musicianship. Let's hear Rocket
Love. I love Serious Fun, too.
It's a great album.
That's a great solo, and it's great. Great lyric, too.
So here's Rocket of Love, and this is heavy.
It is.
Take me,
And let's hear another song off that. This is a Prescott you co-wrote on this one too. Let's drop us 45 seconds into Body Talk.
That's heaven, man.
Yeah.
Heaven.
The way you walk, I listen to your body talk. You work your will. When will it start? Take me, baby, off in a ripple in time. Off in a ripple in time. Oh, it's a ripple in time. When you touch me.
So I remember in 1991, I was living in Chicago, and I remember I listened to FM radio, and I hear the guy says, coming up, we're going to play the new single by The Knack. And I was like, that can't be right. That guy's making a mistake. And I was so excited when Serious Fun came out. I was like, The Knack is bad. I did not know.
You were the guy.
Yeah. How often is that phrase used? The Knack is back.
Oh, we used it a couple times.
We actually had The Knack is Black, too. That was going to be our next album. We're going to go Afro wigs and do the whole thing. I thought it would have worked. Let me say something.
Sure.
Again, Burton, look at how many guitar solos are on that record. He arranged most of the harmonies, and they were, you know, right? All the arrangements. There was a lot of three-part sacked harmonies. There's a lot of guitar solos. More than ever, right?
Yeah.
Probably, yeah.
They were. Definitely.
Was that that's a conscious effort to sound.
It's where we were
baby
at that
talk.
Time.
Yeah.
Really.
It's
Doug let go of the reins.
Mm. I actually hadn't heard that stuff in a long time. Sounds good.
But every song you're soloing on pretty much, I Want Love is
that's a good
is
solo.
A great
I like
song.
That solo.
Yeah. That's a great solo. You soloed on that little solo in Serious Fun. You soloed on the next one.
I like my work.
What about
I'm a big fan.
This is a good guy to have in the room with you when you want compliments.
Song. I like that song.
Let's Get Lost is another really good song. The solo, what is the third song? The long drawn out one where he does that rap on it. Da 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 da. Da 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 bump.
Well, we were just hearing Body Talk.
Yeah, I think that was Body Talk.
No. It's the one that sounds like. No.
It's not I Want Love?
Dum, dum, da, 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 da.
Is it the dog one?
Oh, dum. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's not Doing the Dog. Doing the Dog actually ended up the only other song by The Knack to get into a movie was in The Next Karate Kid, starring
Hilary Swank. Yeah. And by the way, Doing the Dog, Doug wrote that about my girlfriend at the time.
Oh, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but if you really listen, that song, too, you know what it is. I don't know why you're forgetting it. But that solo was great. Dum, ba, ba, da, da, da.
Oh, look, yes. Yes. I'm serious.
River of Sighs.
I haven't heard that album in so long.
Soloing.
Revisit it, Burton.
But I do it because I critique it in my mind to see what songs I think, only because I'm curious. Mm-hmm. But every song has a guitar solo in it.
Yeah.
And they're really good. So that
That's
album.
That's why I liked it so much.
So I did. But it's true. And the vocal harmonies were very three part harmonies.
Well, again, that's what we were doing at the time.
Right.
But that was what it was.
A really, really big band at the time was Def Leppard. And I thought they were great.
Yeah.
That's right. And however much of it was Mutt Lange, but those productions. And also, there's this thing that Mutt Lange would do in their songs, or they would do, that there were these hook sections where you start with the hook riff, and then you start with the four bars of the straight ahead rocker. This is a song you can all jump in, and then what was always my favorite part of the song would be the B section, the pre-chorus, where he would start laying in those chorus, give me your lovin', and he's got the jangle guitar under it. And then the chorus would be the primal, are you digging it? And I thought at the time, man, that's great. That's really great pop songwriting and guitar oriented. And so we started doing that. Yeah. Doug was listening a lot to Zeppelin at the time. So we would do things that were more kind of like power trio driven.
Yeah, when you mention Def Leppard now and I think of Serious Fun, I can totally see a little bit of an influence there going on. Now.
But how do we get, how long do we have?
We have
don't
about
have a lot of time. Maybe we should do a
15
two-parter.
Minutes.
How the hell are we going to get the next 20 years?
I don't know how we're going to do it.
But we're gonna jump to right now. We're going to go to 1998.
Zoom.
Let me tell you something. For me,
This is my favorite Knack album.
This is the one.
I love Zoom because I like to whisper when I tell
the
listeners.
He doesn't want to get like arrows thrown at him.
Right.
It's the best way to emphasize is to whisper.
Yes. Do you guys like Zoom? Because
I like it very much.
I love Terry Bozzio's drums.
I don't like the snare drum.
Snare drum had this weird ping to it that was
What is it? Is it tight? Is it loose? Yeah. What makes that sound?
It was bullshit.
It was neither of those, Pat.
When we first started recording with Terry, he used a small kit. We had to get an extra mixing board in because he had 24 fucking tracks for drums.
Oh yeah, we saw you perform at the Galaxy Theater, and we walked in, and I said, "Is the Knack playing or is Yes playing tonight? What's going on?"
Return to Forever.
By the way, please, anybody out there, I will pay money. There is not one video or live performance I have heard of any of our shows with Terry.
Really?
Yep. And I'm telling you, right?
Like
I've never
that.
Heard it. The highlight of the show was myself and Burton when we look at each other when Terry would do his solo. Because we're trying to keep time, right?
Oh, God.
There was a great song called Good Enough, which Burton wrote, obviously. And we're keeping time. And going, what the fuck?
Well, that was
doing?
Actually, he would take a solo in the encore, which is Mona and I Fade Away.
No, but he did it in Good Enough, too, didn't he? No?
Yeah, but what you're thinking of is it's the kind of solo where the band does the vamp, and then you solo, and the solo gets more and more elaborate, then you come back to the vamp.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Terry had this like time signature shit going on was like, so we go ba ba ba, and me and Prescott are just trying to lock our feet together. One, two, three.
He was playing time in
because
time.
He was just playing this circular shit.
I don't think I'm lying when I say I'm pretty sure he had a gong on stage.
Oh yeah,
he had a gong.
He had a gong, tom toms, chimes,
kick drums. But the thing is, that shouldn't have happened. He shouldn't have done. But it's funny because that album, the sounds we got, and the drum sound especially, some parts were good, but that was the time to take authority by Doug to say, you know, Terry, it doesn't sound right. Use the other snare.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen. We
walk
just
me through why Terry Bozzio. Explain that.
He seems like. How did that come up?
Well, very simple. After we did the Viper Room show, we recorded, we got a new manager, Danny Sugarman. May I rest, bless the man, you know what I mean? And he said, you got to write, because Doug had some songs for a solo album he was going to do, and Doug said they're going to be a Knack album, and they weren't good enough. So Danny said, no, you got to write new songs. So a lot of the songs came from their collaboration. I contributed, and it became something really good. Bruce was negotiating for something he felt he needed and wanted from the Knack, and he wasn't getting what he wanted. And he just said, try to screw up our deal with Rhino at the time a little bit, and said, fuck it, I don't want to do it. So we went through the drummer list. Doug, I don't know how he did it, but we got Terry, and Doug met with him, and they really hit it off.
Okay.
And Terry really actually said he wanted to join the band, which I can't believe. He changed his mind soon after.
Like he wanted to be a full member.
Yeah. Okay. And that changed as soon
as we
were on
the
road.
Of course we wanted him to be as well.
Yeah.
I think the reasoning was...
He's a great drummer. We're not saying he's not. He's a fantastic drummer.
Yeah, we paid him a lot of money.
He's a drum god.
Yeah, he's amazing.
But to me, a little overkill for the Knack.
He played simple on a lot of those tracks, right?
Not live!
I wasn't there.
The reasoning probably was, and this is 15 years ago now, if you can believe it.
I believe it.
That... Bruce sets the bar really high for a drummer of the
Absolutely.
Knack. And if you heard somebody who was a timekeeper with the Knack, it would just fall so far flat.
Yeah, okay.
And frankly, there just aren't that many drummers with those kind of chops who can also just play like a rock and roll band. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that's when Terry said he wanted to do it.
Yeah.
It was like, oh my God, we actually have somebody with chops coming out of his ears.
Gotcha.
You know, who was also in a rock band himself.
And some people said he wasn't a good rock drummer, which I heard before we even started. Yeah. However,
people say things.
Ironically, I'm playing with Missing Persons now without Terry.
Is that right?
Yeah, I've been playing with him for 2 years.
I didn't know that.
Terry,
come on, Burton, go see your buddy.
I don't know anything.
Burton, Prescott, Burton.
Yeah, haven't you guys figured that out by now?
but you know, he's always invited and he can do anything he wants. But anyway, re-listening to Terry, he's a fucking great drummer. The sound he got on that album, Ken Scott produced it.
Uh-huh.
Fucking great drums. That should have been our drum sound. But we made a deal with Terry. It started out to be a real high for me because I figured he'd bring musical credibility to the band. White House Terry Bozzio playing with the Knack,
right.
Remember?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this started out unfortunately, Rhino Records did not know how to promote a new album
because they didn't handle like new releases. It was all catalog releases.
They didn't handle people that were actually living
and recording new music.
Well, we had a new manager at the time, and he was saying, you know, don't go out and tour. And I agreed with him because it wasn't the right time because he didn't feel we'd be ready. They'd be ready.
Yeah.
We started touring.
It's more than positive, by the way.
Right.
And yeah, well, but they didn't even have the albums in Tower Records. We're playing in a city in Denver. Remember, we got there. And
that's right.
Nobody has the album. Yeah. How do you promote a new album when there's nobody has
and
the album?
And that disillusioned Terry really quickly.
Well, it started to disillusion him. Plus, he started to get a little sick because he came off a bus tour before he went with us. Mm-hmm. Because he was in, can you imagine schlepping Terry Bozzio in an Econo van in the back across the country?
With his drums.
He's getting $5,000 a week, so you figure. But he started to fly after that. But the bad turnout, he got to know Doug on another level. And pretty soon it was like, okay. So last gig we played with Terry was in New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Benoit, whatever the hell the name of the club was.
Benoit's Balls. Yeah, that's where it was.
But it was this club. So it was raining. It was a miserable night. Nobody was there. And I know Terry, before we play, I can't do this anymore.
before you go on.
Yeah, we were friendly with him. We still had shows to do. And I knew probably the shows wouldn't have been, even though we had New York, Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Terry was not well. He really had. Doug had gotten sick a week earlier, was on steroids because he was sick. Actually, that alludes one more second. The weirdest moment in my life was when we played Detroit and Doug's brother introduced us and brought Jack Kevorkian into the dressing room.
Oh, fantastic.
And I looked at Burton and go, this is over. This is the kiss of death, man. And that,
yeah, the Grim Reaper literally just walked in.
In our dressing room. Yeah.
There's there's a music notation software program called Finale.
Okay.
And I was chatting with Jack Kevorkian backstage, and he said, I'm learning to play the flute, and he mentioned the software. I said, I use that all the time because I write musical theater now. Uh-huh. And I find myself basically giving tech support knowledge to Jack Kevorkian.
And he's slowly tying your arm off. He's like, just relax. No, like, Jack, what are you doing now?
He was a genial old man.
Yeah. Anyway, after that gig, so we played a New Jersey show. After the show goes, I'm going home. And I'm going to Burton. I go, Burton, I said, can you please buy me a ticket? I got to go. I mean, I had a wife and I had kids and I had to get back anyway.
Right.
She was pregnant with my son Gabriel, who's actually a drummer now. And Burton was nice enough to allow me to get me a ticket to get the hell out of there. Now, the irony
we got
is,
the hell out of Dodge.
Doug was furious at us because we left. Terry was leaving.
Well, there weren't any
acoustic show. That's great.
No, there weren't going to be any more gigs. The rest of it was canceled. And the van with the
this is the best
had
thing.
To drive back across.
They illegally took the van.
And he thought we
were
like being cop outs for not sticking with the van to drive across with Doug, who's fuming at Terry for just having quit the band. And so we're thinking,
no, but we're leaving. And I was like, fucking glory days are coming until I got home. But then the worst thing is Doug's riding with the road manager we found out was ripping us off on his credit card.
This sounds like a mess.
When he got back. So that was like a bad tour. Anyway, somehow we survived it.
Well, in Terry's defense, though, the main reason he quit is because, again, Rhino didn't really know how to promote us, right? And there was no point to what we were doing. We were playing clubs, and we weren't selling any albums, and we weren't getting our name out there because in those days you didn't get, like, a big review for a club. Right. And so he was saying, I'm busting my ass.
He was getting sick. He really was.
Getting sick,
and he got
and
other
not,
things to do.
He said, if this was doing business for us, it would be different.
Right.
But he was right to do that because he was getting $10,000 a clinic. And he also had a wife and a kid.
Yeah.
And I didn't begrudge him for it at
right.
all.
No.
But he was begrudged.
Let's hear some of that tight snare.
Yeah.
Let me hear Pop is Dead.
Pop
is... Oh, it's right there, right up front, immediately.
Straight from my heart, piercing the blue, on the wall.
So, guys, this has been a pleasure to sit down with you two guys and hear the angel and the devil speak about the Knack.
And that was just the one guy, right?
That was just the one guy. And then Birdie. I call you Birdie.
Yeah.
Birdie chimed in.
All right.
Before we go, I want to let the listeners know that I have four copies of The Knack, Heaven or Rave Up. I'm going to ask Burton and Prescott if they'll sign these, and we'll give you away to the listeners.
We didn't talk about what we're doing today.
No, but I'm going to let you do that. I want to thank Jimmy for helping out today.
An honor to have been asked to be part of this. Thank you.
Thank you. Burton Avare, Prescott Niles, I do want you guys to... I have one question. It's been 12 years since the last Knack album came out. Did you guys record anything with Doug after 2001's Normal Is the Next Guy that we'll ever hear?
No.
You didn't. So there's not. So as a fan like me that thinks maybe there's some archive stuff, there's really not.
Can I say as a fan, Normal Is the Next Guy, another amazing album.
Another amazing underrated album.
A lot of fun. Record.
You're the one.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to release a DVD of Carnegie Hall. Which should be out
there. It should be out there.
It's Capitol blocked. We're trying to own it to get it out there, and God knows.
Yeah, get some audio and video on that.
I would definitely recommend that. That was a really good show.
Yeah, only on Laserdisc only, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is the reissues from 2002 are out of print. So how do we get Knack music?
Oh. iTunes. Doug's sister, who's doing a beautiful job, Beth.
Beth, yes.
Has helped us and helped the brand to get the... It's on iTunes, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it out there?
And on Omnivore Records, we've got those albums that are these great archive recordings of us playing live at the Troubadour.
Yeah.
You literally hear our very first gig at the Whiskey.
Yep.
And it's a special insight. If people are really interested in our band or fans of band, I would strongly recommend that.
Yes. And thanks to Brad Rosenberger from Omnivore Records that sent me four copies of The Knack, Heaven
and got more than me.
Prescott, real quick, tell us what you're doing right now.
Well, besides being here, I'm playing with Missing Persons. I'm playing with some old guys called Classic Rock All-Stars. Playing with Mickey Free, and we're going to do an album with Carmen Appice. And the other guys, the singer used to be in the Plasmatics.
Excellent.
Forget his name. He played bass in the Plasmatics.
Bouvier?
Yeah, but John's a singer, and he plays guitar, and he's worked with Mickey Free. Mickey, he's done some record, whatever. He's a blues guitarist, but he plays a lot of Jimmy stuff. And we jammed recently, and it sounds good, so we may do an album. I work at Taxi Music, which is a company where songwriters from all over the country send in their songs for listings, like film and TV listings, record companies, producers looking for songs. It's also a way for people to learn how to get their songs better. Who's going to tell you? Girlfriend's going to tell you to write a better chorus? So it's been around for a while, Taxi Music.
Cool.
Also, my kids, my offspring, they have a band called Gateway Drugs. They're playing around L.A. My son's drumming, singing. My daughter sings, plays. My other son, Noah, plays, sings. And they're the only people. We just did Sharona together. Wish I could have played it for you.
If you leave it, I'll play it on the next show.
Well, I'll have to get on YouTube for you.
Okay, you get it.
Anyway, all I'm saying is I try to stay current and get out there. And if I could do anything to put a good face on the Knack's legacy, I do my very best.
Excellent. With your positivity.
Yes, exactly.
Sorry, Burton.
Burton, I know that you're out there promoting pastel colors in your wardrobe. And what else are you doing?
Well, my design sense is definitely my identity.
No, it's 'cause he's writing musicals.
First of all, I definitely do not try to stay current. I write musical theater. I write musical comedy. It's a very oddball choice for somebody who came from the band and that kind of thing. But I love it. I'm the composer. My partner Rob Muir is the lyricist. Our other partner Mark Salzman is the playwright, which is called book writer.
Excellent.
And we love the form. We love the history of it. It's never done well anymore, and so that gives us a bar to shoot at.
Yes.
And it's tons of work and tons of fun.
Okay, Greg.
But I hate Burton because he's such a good freaking musician that he won't play, and it really bums me out because he's one of the lesser known, more talented guitarists.
Invite him out.
And he doesn't want to play, and it really maybe we can get a movement going.
No, he's
bring
right.
Burton
I'm lazy. I'm really lazy.
We're gonna close out with a song from Zoom that the two of you wrote together. Harder on You.
Harder on you.
Thank you so much for all the great music over the years, guys.
Burton
Avare, Prescott Niles.
Pleasure.
A round of
peace
applause for The Knack. Check out Harder on You.
on my